Muslims will fight them, and they will be hiding themselves behind the trees and the rocks. Even the trees and the rocks, they hate the Jews. And the trees and the rocks would say, Ya Abdullah, O servant of Allah, come, there is a Jew behind me, kill him.
وارضه غدت برجالها مسيوجة
مسيوجة
لهل العدا سم وطريق اللاوي ولهل الهدى واد وساع فجوجة مرقى براسه والشرف متساوي واسماؤهم
This is Radio
Jihad.
Global Security Matters.
November the 23rd, at least I think it's the 23rd. Let me just check to make sure. I've been living on another planet, it seems, the last few days. Right, and this is Global Security Matters. My name's Adrian Morgan. We have the delectable co-host, Reese Cup, who is going to be managing the switchboard if anybody calls in. And last week, we spent most of the time talking about the problems between Hamas and Israel. Now, after Hamas has been pretty much forced into retreat, and the broker of the ceasefire, which came into effect in the last 48 hours, the broker of that was Egypt's president, Mohamed Morsi. Now, one thing that happened, that's perfectly, I'm just talking to Kel in the chat room, it's perfectly fine, don't worry. Right, now one thing that happened, the president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, who is a senior Muslim Brotherhood figure, agreed with America and Israel and Hamas to negotiate a peace, a truce. It's a very tentative truce. In the first few hours after the truce was signed, 20 missiles from Hamas's territory in Gaza were still fired into the southern regions of Israel, hitting places like Sderot, Ashdod, and Ashkelon. Fortunately, only five people were killed. There was a bus bomb had gone off as well, which made things worse. But while there is now a tentative peace, things have been happening in Egypt which have now put the position of Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt, into a very precarious situation. Now, this is something the Muslim Brotherhood in 1948, when Israel was being voted into existence in the what was then the League of Nations, now we know it as the United Nations, while Israel was being formed, the Special Operations Wing of the Muslim Brotherhood carried out numerous bombings and attacks within Egypt against Jewish citizens, and then this wing sent off 10,000 fighters to fight against the emerging Israeli people from Haganah and other groups who were fighting to become the Israeli nation. Now, in 2007, when you had the issue of Lebanon and Israel being at war with each other, then the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, the supreme guide of the international Ikhwan al-Muslimin, as it is known, the Brotherhood of Muslims, his name was Mahdi Akef. He said that he would also send 10,000 Muslim Brotherhood fighters in to Israel to fight against the Jewish invaders. Now, it must be reminded to people who don't know that Hamas is a wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is written down in their 1998 charter quite specifically. When Hamas was founded by Sheikh Yassin, it was very specifically stating that Jews should not be allowed to live in that land, that the land of Israel is apparently a waqf, W-A-Q-F, which in Islam means it's an endowment from Allah, land that has been invaded by Allah's armies. Even if those armies get chased out, will always, forever and a day, officially should technically belong to Muslims. Now that's why in Spain, the region of Andalusia, or Andalusia, however the Spanish call it, but it's Al-Andalus to Arabs and Muslims. Now, in 1492, the Muslim caliphate, which had carried on there, set up originally in 711 AD when Tariq bin Zayd had invaded Spain, it lasted up until 1492, when Ferdinand and Isabella, the same people who had sent Christopher Columbus off to go and discover what they thought was a route to China or Cathay, when they discovered America, in that time, the Muslims were kicked out of Spain. Since then, every year you have the Moors and Christians carnivals, where they reenact the putting to flight of the Muslim hordes as they saw it. This is something which has caused lots of problems. But still, Cordoba Cathedral, which is built inside a mosque, which was built on top of an original Christian church, you now get frequent cases of Muslims who try to pray inside this Christian cathedral in the manner of Muslims, you know, prostrate on the floor. And at one stage, when a guard tried to stop people from doing this, he was stabbed. That was about 2 or 3 years ago. And Osama bin Laden, when he was alive, frequently told about how this waqf region, Al-Andalus, this region of Spain, should be conquered. Now, this is all the same thing, this concept of, because the land of Israel used to be under Muslim control, it should be, according to Hamas, forever and a day, till Judgment Day, under Muslim control, and Jews should have no right to be there. Hamas has no desire for peace. So the truce is only happening now. It's a temporary thing. They respect force. They don't respect cooperation, it seems. It's the Islamist mindset. But Mohamed Morsi, who was brokering the truce, he was actually getting himself into a good position with the Americans, and he was getting himself into a good position, apparently, with his people. It would have meant more money continuing to come in from USAID, food, money for infrastructure, which is desperately needed in Egypt. Egypt is full of slums. It has massive amounts of poverty. But that's all gone by the book. A couple of days ago, Mohamed Morsi decided that he was going to basically become a supreme leader of Egypt, and that he was going to ban any challenges from the judiciary to any decree that he makes, to any laws, any decisions. He had suddenly put himself into the position of being a dictator. Now, I sort of postulated, yesterday on a forum that this was perhaps because there are a few disagreements within the Muslim Brotherhood leadership. And it seems I was right, because what happened, these disagreements. Now, going back to when the Arab Spring was starting, in Egypt, the Arab Spring began in the start of 2011, in January, and they really, by about February, March, were taking off big time. Now, just before Hosni Mubarak, the dictator, the leader of Egypt, the pro-American general, Hosni Mubarak, before he was deposed and put on trial, an announcement was made on the Muslim Brotherhood English language website saying that only a handful of people, including Mohamed Morsi, or Mercy as he's also called, were allowed to speak on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, when you make a statement like that, it indicates there are little rifts going on. Now, when you make a public statement that you've got to say, only believe these few people and not the others, then you know there is a bigger problem. And these things don't go away with an edict. And what happened is, today, as a reaction to what went on, when Morsi yesterday had made this announcement that he was the supreme leader of Egypt, and he was trying to justify it by saying he was doing it to make it easier for democracy to happen. Now, this is the same sort of argument that Hitler used when, after the Kristallnacht, he created a crisis. No, it was actually after the burning of the Reichstag, sorry. You know, he created a crisis in Germany to then say, well, you know, I'm in power, I'm going to now remain as the Chancellor because we have an emergency going on, even though it's an emergency that's artificial. And then he never left until, you know, he had to leave. Now, this is what Morsi, however you call it, the President of Egypt, has done. And today there has been a backlash. Now, the backlash has led to the main offices in Alexandria being attacked and burned. It has also led to various other Muslim Brotherhood departments having stones thrown at them. 100 people have been injured at the latest count. Massive amounts of people have gathered in Tahrir Square, Liberation Square, the square where everybody gathered when the Arab Spring was starting back in the beginning of 2011, and now they're calling for Mercy on Morsi to go. And now, as I said, Mohamed Morsi, he is the head of he's the president of Egypt, but he is not, he's a very senior Muslim Brotherhood figure, but he is not himself the supreme guide. Now, what is very interesting is that while Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood offices have been attacked and set on fire, Mohamed Badi, who is now the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, the supreme guide, has now tried to bring everything back to saying, let's have a jihad, a holy war against Israel. Just after Morsi has agreed a peace treaty, brokered a peace treaty, now we have got to the point where the rift in the Muslim Brotherhood is really, really big. Now, what Mohamed Badi is doing, calling for a jihad, it's a big distraction from the problems at home. It's a big distraction. He hopes it will unite people together. But he's not elected. He's just the supreme guide of the Muslim Brotherhood. Mohamed Morsi has thrown away democracy to say, I am the leader of Egypt, I am basically infallible, and there is nothing the judiciary can do to stop me. One of his very shrewd moves he made was to take Mohamed Tantawi. Mohamed Tantawi was the head of the army under Hosni Mubarak. He sacked him. He was a very powerful man. But instead of sacking him and throwing him out into the wilderness where he could perhaps cause a counter-revolution, he made Mohamed Tantawi into a paid advisor on a high salary, which is a very clever, shrewd move by Morsi, part of the consolidation of powers under his rule. But now Mohamed Badi, the supreme guide, is coming out with a different message. So it seems there is a big rift at the heart of the Muslim Brotherhood. And all the supreme guide can do is to try to take the heat off is to try to revive the jihad, just as the special wing of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1948 sent 10,000 fighters into Israel to fight the emerging Israeli nation. Just as in 2007, the last supreme guide of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mahdi Akev, said that he was going to send 10,000 fighters into Israel to fight them when they were fighting against the Lebanese. This is something that really shows there is a big problem. Now, I don't want to dwell on the Muslim Brotherhood too much, but they are so important. You know, while you've got this thing of Al-Qaeda and terrorists, and people try to make out that the Muslim Brotherhood is peaceful, and you have so many Muslim Brotherhood front groups, people, when Ingrid Mattson was the head of the Islamic Society of North America, she, Isna, she was being invited to iftar dinners at the White House. Dalia Mojahed, who is suspected to be a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, has been an advisor to Osama bin Laden. To President Obama. I am so sorry. How could I get those two confused? And the amount of groups in Europe, in America, who have had the ear of government. I mean, there was a very famous character. The very first person to introduce iftar dinners in the White House was a man called Abdurrahman Alamoudi. He was finally jailed in 2002. He had taken money from Gaddafi to go and kill the man who is now King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. He was sentenced to 23 years in jail for terrorism, but he used to frequently be a guest at the Clinton White House. He made a name for himself by calling out in 2000, I think it was October 2000, he had called out at Lafayette Square at a meeting, "We are all Hezbollah, we are all Hamas now." So you have these groups and people who are connected to the global Muslim Brotherhood. Now, if the Muslim Brotherhood, where it is strongest, where its roots start in Egypt, if the Muslim Brotherhood is cracking down the middle in its higher echelons, this is very, very, very interesting. It could create a lot of waves, and it could be the beginning of the end of one of the most coherent entryist groups in history taking over silently. The silent jihad. I mean, so many people have spoken. I mean, there was a man called Muhammad Akram who spoke about destroying America from the inside. You had Omar Ahmed, Muslim Brotherhood member again, one of the co-founders of CARE, who said in California in, I think it was 1998, Islam isn't in America to be subservient, it is in America to become dominant. We have, throughout Europe as well, people like the UOIF, which is the French Muslim Brotherhood group, in staunchly secular France. Nicolas Sarkozy, before he even became president, was channeling taxpayers' money to fund this Islamist group. We had in Britain, Tony Blair was being advised by the Muslim Brotherhood. A group called the Muslim Council for Britain was giving him advice. And in June 2005, he made a man called Iqbal Sukrani, who was head of this Muslim Brotherhood front group, he made him a knight of the British Empire. That was in June 2005. This is the same man who had said about Salman Rushdie that death would be too good for him. This is a man who attended the memorial service for Sheikh Yassin, the founder of Hamas, the terrorist organization which has killed hundreds of Israeli civilians and soldiers. And this character, Iqbal Sukrani had tried in 1996 to have Osama bin Laden given a visa to come to Britain to lecture people. He called him not only an Islamic scholar, he later called him a freedom fighter. And this character, who had given advice to Tony Blair, he had tried to make a blasphemy law in Britain so that nobody could blaspheme against Islam. Tony Blair had gone along with it. And in 2005 June, he knighted this character, Iqbal Sukrani, who then, a month later, tried to pretend that, you know, the 7/7 bombings, which happened a month after that, where 52 people were blown to bits on three tube trains in one bus, had nothing to do with Islam. I mean, the divisions that the Muslim Brotherhood has been sowing, the political pressures it has been able to apply to Western governments around the world, if this organization is splitting down the middle, if it is having cracks within its higher leadership, this is something, hopefully, those cracks can be exploited. Those cracks can be used. And hopefully it will put the plans, because there are plans. Muhammad Akram, who I mentioned, in 1990, he had a document which was talking about how the Muslim Brotherhood was going to infiltrate America, how it was going to get inside its institutions and destroy it from within. Similarly, you have the project. This was a thing I've talked about with Morty, who isn't here yet, but he will be here later, I hope. The project was written by Saeed Ramadan, who was the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hassan al-Banna himself, he was the son of a watchmaker and a teacher, and in 1928... he, with five other people, founded the Muslim Brotherhood. Initially, it was a revivalist group to get young people to not be chasing girls, but to be thinking about Allah and getting themselves all pure in faith, and it encouraged them to play soccer. And very soon, it became very politicized, and eventually, in 1949, in a Cairo market, Hassan al-Banna was shot dead. There was a purge against the Muslim Brotherhood. Many members fled, many to Switzerland. And in Switzerland, Saeed Ramadan had taken refuge, and he was married to the daughter of Hassan al-Banna. He is the father of Tariq Ramadan, who you must have heard of. And he had written, apparently in 1981, this document called The Project, which set out a plan of how the global Muslim Brotherhood, over a period of about up to 100 years, should be infiltrating civil rights groups. And this is what, you know, CARE calls itself, you know, the Council for American Islamic Relations calls itself a civil rights group, an advocacy group. Even though this is a group which frequently appears, it has members like Doug Hooper, Ibrahim Hooper, sorry, that's his real name is Doug Hooper, he used to be a TV executive. They go out to Iran. They are frequently seen on Press TV, which is an Iranian-funded broadcast operation. That is nothing American about that. Iran has said that it wants to destroy America. So why is the leadership of CARE having any dealings with Iran, which is a sworn enemy of the West and of America? And this is how the Muslim Brotherhood are operating. They are making all sorts of strange alliances. And this is something that if there is a rift that's happening in the Muslim Brotherhood, it is only to be welcomed, because they have plans, and this plan of the project is very, very detailed. I will talk about that later. Now, we're coming up with 24 minutes into the show. I have a lot of stories today which I really think are just very interesting. Okay, now, in Britain, there has been a radio station has been fined £4,000, which is about $6,000, because a woman called Sister Ruby has said that gay people should be tortured and beaten up. This is in Leeds. It's a radio station called Radio Asian Fever. Now, in Britain, Asian means South Asian, mainly for people of Indian origin, etc., or Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi origin. And she has had absolutely no punishment at all. The radio station has been given a huge fine, but she's saying that they should. She said, Allah states, if they do such a deed, punish them both physically and mentally. Mental punishment means rebuke them, beat them, humiliate them, admonish and curse them, and beat them up. This command was sent in the beginning because capital punishment had not yet been sent down. This is the voice of tolerance. This is the voice of, no, you can't say anything bad about Islam, but Islam and its followers seem to think they can say everything bad about the rest of the world. Anyway, that's one little thing. Now, there have been various stories coming up. They're pretty unpleasant. In Italy, there's been a story which is, let's first deal with Nottingham. She's in the middle of Britain. There's a pretty unpleasant story about a cross which was wrapped in ham and then was left on the doorstep of a home belonging to a Muslim family in a place called Bingham, which is it's in the centre of Britain. They just moved into a new home. And this cross, it's a very cheaply made. Someone's just, you know, put two bits of stick together with a piece of string and then wrapped bacon or ham around the around it. I mean, it's a very childish, very nasty, unpleasant action. But it's regarded as news. And things like that, I really think they're destructive. But I used to live in a Jewish area in London, a place called Stamford Hill. And I remember in 1978, there was not only a pig's head that was in the street that had been put there to intimidate Jews in the same way as pig's heads and bits of ham are used to intimidate Muslims. This pig's head had been chopped into four pieces and just left by the side of the road. And in Italy, they're now making fuss in the news there in Milan. A severed pig's head has been found in Milan in an arena where the local Islamic community holds weekly prayers. Now, this is a concert and sports venue. Every Friday, 9,000 Muslims, you know, have their Friday or Juma prayers there. And the vice mayor of Milan is saying, this is intolerable, it is light years away from the city of dialogue, of tolerance we are building. Okay, I mean, this is, I mean, I certainly do not condone such actions, but it is only a pig's head. This is, we have just got situations where people are killing other people. We have Islamists calling for the destruction of Israel. We have people influencing governments, and then people are making big news stories about a pig's head which is found in a venue. Okay, it's unpleasant, but it's been going on for a long time, that sort of activities, and never used to make headlines. Now these things are treated as news. Bizarre. A banker in London has said that he has lost his job because he is not a Muslim. Now, he was working at a Kuwaiti-owned investment bank. He was making a six-figure salary, so he's making a lot of money. He's called James Bagshaw. He was receiving £185,000 a year, which is about $270,000. And he was the chief operating officer at the Gatehouse Bank. And he said that, let me just get the story up properly. He earned more than $1 million in pay and bonuses during 4 years with the bank. He says they got rid of him because he raised concerns about a £100 million investment with the Financial Services Authority. Now, the Financial Services Authority in Britain, basically, it does investigations. And he's now gone to an employment tribunal, and he is saying, it is my view that my race, nationality, ethnic background, or religion or beliefs have been a factor in my dismissal. And I do not believe that Gatehouse, this is the name of this Kuwaiti-owned Sharia finance group, has provided any evidence to rebut this view. He said the facts remains that the chairman of the bank, a man called Farhad Budai, as a Muslim, chose to involve a person called Mr. Duno, who's another Muslim, in the Kuwaiti Investment Authority, to the exclusion of his UK-based executive team, none of whom were Muslim. So, I mean, it seems pretty much that, you know, this is a case that's going on. I can't really comment too much on it because it hasn't come to a conclusion yet. But it does seem that these banks, I mean, giving it a name like Gatehouse, it all sounds all very nice and normal, but it is really a Sharia bank, and we have to remember that the very first Sharia bank that became introduced into the West, the BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, run by a man called Khalid bin Mahfouz, ended up with money being siphoned off to support terrorism, which is why it was forced to close down. Khalid bin Mahfouz, he has been mentioned in Congress as supporting terrorism. Madeleine Albright had said that after the 1998 bombings, which took place, in the twin bombings in August 1998, which happened with in Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, the capital of Tanzania, and also in Nairobi in Kenya, you had two American embassies on one day in two different countries. These two American embassies were bombed by Al-Qaeda, and according to Madeleine Albright, she had said that money had been transferred by Khalid bin Mahfouz, a Saudi banker who had set up the very first Sharia bank, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. He had put money into the accounts of people connected with the carrying out of the bombing. Now, she had said that. It was reported in Congress. Despite that, for mentioning the fact of what Madeleine Albright had said, what has been mentioned before Congress, my friend Rachel Ehrenfeld was banned. She was then taken to court because she mentioned it in her book, Funding Evil. She was taken to court in Britain, even though only 38 copies of her book had arrived in Britain. Her book was published in America. Khalid bin Mahfouz claimed that he had been libeled, even though this was a fact, what she was reporting. She wasn't saying something she had invented. She was just recording that Madeleine Albright had made this claim. He took her to court, and she refused to come to Britain. Because she refused to come to Britain, she was found guilty of libeling him. And she can never come to Britain because she has to pay all of his costs, even though he died in August 2008. She still cannot come to Britain, but as a result of her campaigning, she used to get in Manhattan where she lives, she would have Khalid bin Mahfouz's lawyers were trying to get money out of her, trying to take her to court in Manhattan. First, her lawyers managed to get a law that was passed in Manhattan that, because in Britain we don't have the same rights as you do in America, if somebody accuses me of libel in Britain, it's not up to the accuser to make the case that I've libeled him or her. It's for me to prove that I didn't. Therefore, it's in total contradiction and contravention of the First Amendment. And this whole notion of the guilty person, the accuser, doesn't have to make a case, but the person who's accused has to then prove their innocence. That's your being your guilty before you've even... This notion of your being innocent till proven guilty does not apply in British libel law. British libel law is crazy. It is insane. So, she had a law, was introduced in Manhattan, saying the New York district that it was impossible for any libel claims from a country which doesn't have those same First Amendment rights cannot be pursued. You can't ask for money if you, you know, and there was a precedent before, but she has basically, she won that case, and then other states in America took up the cause, and then finally Obama did sign the Speech Act in 2010, in which, in British law, you can't do it. Now, do you remember the case of Roman Polanski? Roman Polanski, I mean, he was a brilliant film director, but he had sex with a 13-year-old girl who he had drugged. He admitted this and then fled bail and fled to France. Now, when Vanity Fair, an American magazine, had said that Roman Polanski had been, after, you know, his wife Sharon Tate was murdered by the Manson family in 1969. Now, he, in this article in Vanity Fair, a woman claimed that she saw him in a restaurant in New York in 1969, just weeks after his wife had been murdered. She was pregnant. She was 8.5 months pregnant when she was killed by the Manson gang, that he was trying to seduce this other woman. Now, apparently the story wasn't true. I mean, Mia Farrow gave evidence, but he, instead of taking Vanity Fair to court in America, where the magazine was being published, Polanski used British libel law to then say that he was going to take this American publication to court. Now, he couldn't appear in Britain, because if he appeared in Britain in person, he could be arrested and deported, and taken to America to face trial for his crime, which he admitted he did, where he drugged and had sex with a 13-year-old girl. She may have looked a bit older, but she was still a child. Now, he had a video link, and this same judge who had helped Khalid bin Mahfouz prosecute Rachel Ehrenfeld and 31 other people at least, which is whom Khalid bin Mahfouz had stopped from publishing information. This situation, this judge, a man called David Eady, or Justice David Eady as the title of the High Court judge is for him, he has twisted the law. He got George Galloway awarded a libel case for not because the libel facts were wrong, but because the newspaper that said that he had received money from Saddam Hussein, it was reported in a document found in Iraq, said that he had received money from Saddam Hussein. The story was factual. But Justice David Eady had said, oh, well, Galloway hadn't been asked by the newspaper, therefore he was found, the newspaper was found guilty, and they had to pay Galloway money. So this is how skewed and bizarre British libel law is. Polanski didn't even appear in Britain because he could have been done for child molestation and deported to America to face trial for that. he was able to win the case against Vanity Fair, again under this Mr. Justice David Eady, who's a total turd. I can probably get put in the Tower of London for saying that. But this is the problem that we have in a country like Britain with our libel laws. They have been used to silence information about funding of jihad. Now, terrorist funding, I mentioned the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, the very first Sharia banking. Sharia banking doesn't operate through having profits. It operates through all these weird little schemes. Very, very, very shady. Very hard to chase the money, to find out where it goes. Just like the Hawala schemes, you know, which were one way that people avoided. According to the Islam, you cannot have profit or usury. Now, because of that, they have developed schemes to get around that. Now, the very first Sharia bank, BCCI, the very first Muslim bank in the West, took lots of people's savings. They thought, oh, it's a Muslim bank, I'm a Muslim, therefore it's right to put my money in there. And they, nothing wrong with them doing that. They were right to try to do that. But Khalid bin Mahfouz, who ran the bank, didn't seem to mind that one of his operatives was siphoning off money and giving it to terrorist organizations. This was a long time back. This was before bin Laden was known about. This is before, you know, this is when Al-Qaeda was just starting. And that was when the very first Sharia bank had to stop because it was funding terrorism. And Khalid bin Mahfouz was the man behind that bank. And he has used British libel law. There's another man I know called Jean-Charles Brissard. He's a Frenchman based in Geneva in Switzerland. He also writes about terrorist funding. And he, too, has ended up being sued in Britain, even though his book was in French, wasn't even written in English. And he has been sued by Khalid bin Mahfouz in Britain and has been unable to... came to more than $1 million in fees that he had to pay, he and his co-author. Even Cambridge University Press, there was a book called... Alms for Jihad, about terrorist funding. Khalid bin Mahfouz stopped the, by using British libel laws, he stopped not only the publication of this book, he ordered, and it was then followed through, libraries around the world removed this book from its shelves, purely because it had stated what Madeleine Albright had said, that he had put money in the bank accounts of... he had put money into the bank accounts of people who had carried out the 1998 embassy twin bombings in Nairobi and in Tanzania. This, when you have British libel law actually stopping the truth getting out, no wonder you end up with stupid, dim-witted presidents and congressmen who haven't got a bloody clue about what is going on and think, oh, the Muslim Brotherhood's great. Oh, Islamism isn't really a threat. Oh, Osama bin Laden isn't practicing true Islam. While you have people who are dissembling and using twisted, disgusting laws like Britain's libel laws to silence the truth, okay, you now have the Speech Act, so you can publish things in America. But if you publish things in America and they get read in Britain, you can be taken to court. And if you have a massive million-dollar fine against you, because that the fine will only be for £10,000, but you will have all of the lawyer's fees of your plaintiff, who will be, you know, those fees will be put onto your fees, it becomes really limiting. And that makes discussion of the facts about terrorism funding very hard to follow. And why it is very difficult when you got most of the Sharia banking, which is being set up, the largest amalgamated group of Sharia bankers and Sharia banking operations meet regularly and are based in Ireland. They're based in Ireland because Ireland has a stupid constitution that says you cannot insult any religion. So they could bring out blasphemy claims to say, oh, you're investigating our Sharia justice of, you know, our finance. That's our religion. And the money trails, then they don't get chased. It's like a labyrinthine Byzantine complexity that these people are setting up under everybody's noses. It's too complicated for a simple person to understand, even the Muslim, because it's all involved with layers and layers and layers of different names and different things going on, and you cannot get to the root cause of where this Sharia financing is going. Is it going back into Islam? Is it going back into charity? When you have, in the past, the charity involved terror training and terror financing, as happened with the BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was involved with terrorist financing, you have all sorts of problems. Anyway, I've been ranting for too long. I've been going for 45 minutes. I'm going to play a little bit of very nice music from Elgar, and hopefully I can have a quick pee in that time. Well, that's too much information, but still. This is Elgar, Chanson de Matin, Song of the Morning, if I can get the bloody thing to play. Okay, that was Chanson de Matin, a song of the morning by Elgar, a British composer who was alive, I think he died in the 1930s. Now, Anne wants a link to that. I will try and provide her one later. Now, I want to give my plugs now. I want to remind people that there is a show later by Kel, the Red Fox internet radio show, which is, again, on Blog Talk Radio. Now, that ends, that begins when this show ends. Now, we've got another 1 hour and 10 minutes left here. When this show ends, then that will start. Now, Kel Fitzgerald, who's in the chat room now, she will be running that show. Also, I want to give a link to the, it's Shabbos, and it's like the Rabbi Ariel Nachman Ben Chaim also has on live stream, if you look up Seven Beggars Synagogue, beggars as in, you know, paupers, you know, people wanting things, B-E-G-G-A-R-S, Seven Beggars Synagogue. He has got an online Shabbos service. I will be going to that at the end of the show. I'm hoping that Morty will be calling in soon. But if you listen into that, now he, Rabbi Ariel Nachman Ben Chaim, is one of the people who is very, very good at making the wisdom of old Hebrew texts come alive. He is a very amazing person. So please, if you can, try and listen to him as well. Now, another thing I want to give a plug for, as I always give a plug for, is Crystal and James Epley in Broadway in Virginia, and their wonderful honey, the Mud E. Acres Farm. It's based in Broadway, Virginia, and the number for that, if I can just bring a light over here. Now, they sell and they dispatch all sorts of honey, in large jars or in honey bears, which are little tiny 12-ounce bottles, plastic bottles shaped like a bear. Now, the honey is delicious, but they're also adding new honey, including jalapeno honey, which is pretty amazing. These are new strains, but the traditional honey on its own is absolutely delicious. The number to contact them, and they do export. Now, I'm living in Britain, but I have had wonderful honey delivered to me here. Their number is for Broadway, Virginia, for Muddy Acres Farm, is 540-896-8938. Now, I also want to say, if anybody wants to call in, I normally give a, you know, little plug at the beginning if people want to call in. The number is a New York number, 347-857-1380. If you want to call in, please do so, and we can chat and give us your opinions on what you think about the world and what's going on. I was meant to be writing an article about Sharia finance for an Australian publication, but I have been told they are going to refuse to have any articles about Islam or Islamism up until the end of the year. This is a group, where this newspaper organization has been founded to fight communism. But its vice president will not allow anybody to say anything bad about Islam or Islamism. Even though Islam is, I think, one of the shittiest religions on the planet. Did I say that? Yes, I did. But still, it's a free country still. Well, Britain isn't, but at least America is. Now, let's go back to this anti-Semitism, which seems to run rampant. It's written in the Quran, it's in the Hadiths. You know, when they say that Jews are descendants of apes and pigs, and where in Surah 9:29 it says in the Quran that Jews and Christians must pay a tax in order to live with Muslims in Muslim societies, they must pay a special tax, and they must pay this special tax. In one translation, the words are humbly, as little ones, i.e., they pay a tax as sub-second-class, subservient second-class citizens. This is what the jizya tax is about. this is there are elements within Islam which, while they are not being addressed and reformed, are always going to lead to things like anti-Semitism. And this fight against Israel, it's not just about the territory, it's pure anti-Semitism. Yes, the song, Anne, was Song of the Morning. Okay, right. Now, on this issue, in Norway, in Oslo, now I mentioned this a couple of weeks back, there's a man called Arslan Ubaydullah Maruf Hussein. Now, he has made threats. He's an Islamic mullah or imam. Now, he was arrested at the end of October because he'd made statements on his Facebook group page, which basically were, he's from Pakistan originally, he's age 27. He's been indicted for issuing threats against two journalists. He's also, when he was taken to court, he threatened an expert witness during the trial proceedings. But he was saying that he would protect Jews with an AK-47. In the way that he was saying, he was basically saying that, you know, yes, I'll protect you when I've got a gun to keep you under control. So he has been kept in custody, but unfortunately, the Supreme Court has ruled that even though he's still got indictments against him for threatening Jews and for physically attacking witnesses, that there is no reason, the Supreme Court in Oslo in Norway has said there's no reason for him to continue being held in custody. Even though the police have asked, you know, they've even asked him personally to remain in custody. I mean, how do you ask somebody to remain in a prison cell? They're not going to do that. So, unfortunately, this character, having already made threats and actively attacked people in his trial, is now, and threatening Jewish people specifically, he has been allowed out. This is something that really, the blatant anti-Semitism of literalist Muslims, most Muslims aren't anti-Semitic in the way that we normally see anti-Semitism as being, but the people who are Salafists, the people who take Islam literally as the word of God that must be obeyed, rather than the word of a rather dodgy character called Muhammad, it becomes very, very problematic. So anyway, that's one story. There are various other ones. I've got this wonderful quote later. I don't know if I can actually give it out because it's so full of bad words. I've just something that somebody sent me a link to. And it's on, well, somebody on a forum, she quoted from what Cossacks had said to this Ottoman person who was saying that, you know, they should be subservient. I think I will read it out because it is so entertaining. Let me just find it, because I do think, I mean, this is just something absolutely, it is hilarious. I mean, it shouldn't be hilarious because it really is quite, but still, I'm going to read it out, and I will have to, where it uses the F word, I will just have to say F, and you will know what I mean. But this is from 1640. It's just a dialogue. Let me just find it and speak it out to you. I think I copied it on the other one. I will find it again. Sorry about that. But it is very, 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 very funny. These Cossacks were being told that they must submit to the superior values of this descendant of Muhammad, and it was all this grandiose language, and then the language that they use in return. I must read it out to you because I think you will be entertained. I was very entertained. I was splitting my sides, you know, when I read this. So I will try. Okay. Now, this was from 1676. Okay. Now, the Sultan, Mahmud IV, the Ottoman Sultan from Turkey, was telling them that they must become subservient to him. So, he sent out a letter to them, a decree, to the Zaporozhian Cossacks. Now, this is his decree. His decree states, "As the Sultan, son of Muhammad, brother of the sun and moon, grandson and viceroy of God, ruler of the kingdoms of Macedonia, Babylon, Jerusalem, Upper and Lower Egypt, emperor of emperors, sovereign of sovereigns, extraordinary knight, never defeated, steadfast guardian of the tomb of Jesus Christ, trustee chosen by God himself, the hope and comfort of Muslims, confounder and great defender of Christians, I command you, the Zaporozhian Cossacks, to submit to me voluntarily and without any resistance, and to desist from troubling me with your attacks." That's a very, very bold statement. And this was the reply. I mean, I'm sorry, this is a translation from 1676. The Zaporozhian Cossacks to the Turkish Sultan. Okay, now, I will have to, I can't say, give out all of the words, but I will, I'll give out most of them. This is their response, the translation of the, what they said in Russian. "Thou art a Turkish imp, the damned devil's brother and friend, and a secretary to Lucifer himself. What the devil kind of knight art thou that thou cannot slay a hedgehog with your naked ass? The devil shits and your army eats. Thou son of a bitch wilt not ever make subjects of Christian sons. We have no fear of your army. By land and sea we will battle with thee. F thy mother. Thou art the Babylonian scullion, Macedonian wheelwright, brewer of Jerusalem, goat effer of, you know what I mean there, of Alexandria, swineherd of Greater and Lesser Egypt, Armenian pig, Podolian villain, catamite of Tartary." A catamite is a boy prostitute. "Hangman of Kamyanets, and fool of all the world and underworld, a fool before our God, a grandson of the serpent, and the crick in our dick, pig snout, mare's arse, slaughterhouse cur, unchristened brow, screw thine own mother. So the Zaporozhians declare, thou lowlife, thou wilt not even be herding Christian pigs. Now we shall conclude, for we don't know the date and do not have a calendar. The moon month is in the sky, the year in the book, the day is the same over here as it is over there. For this, kiss our ass." This was signed by Koshovyi Ottoman Ivan Sirko with the whole Zaporozhian host. It's a pretty brilliant reply. It is so blasphemous. I mean, of course, I would never dare blaspheme against Islam. You know, I am just reporting this for historical purposes because, obviously, we don't want to be provocative on this show. We want to be nice. We want to hug fluffy bunnies and say trees are wonderful. But I just thought that was brilliant. I mean, it's a shame I can't read it out in its full, unexpurgated filth and depravity. But it's just, I mean, it's just so wonderful when you think about how pompous the Sultan Mahmud's letter was. It's just brilliant. Sorry. I found that very, very entertaining. Now, it seems Morty has disappeared. I expect he probably is cooking, as was suggested down here. Now, let's get to some more items of news. There's been a bomb attack at a Shia mosque in Pakistan. More sectarian. This is what happens. A country like Pakistan, it has so many bombings. And yet, instead of declaring itself to be secular, and trying to make out that people's religion should be their private business, the fact that it tries to promote one form of Islam, the Sunni form of Islam, neglects the fact that there are quite a few Shias in the country. It seems to be encouraging all the time the conditions which lead for real problems. Now, there's another bit of news just coming out, which it's in a northwestern Pakistani town. Let's just bring up this story. It's in Peshawar. Now, Peshawar is getting up, it's in what's called the Northwest Frontier Province. This is very close to the Afghan border. It was a suicide bomber. There was a Shia gathering in a northwestern town. It was 165 kilometers southwest of Peshawar, and only two policemen were injured in the blast, apparently, fortunately, because what happened was District Police Chief Idris Khan said a suicide bomber was coming in an auto rickshaw towards a Shia gathering at their worship place. Police stopped the rickshaw at a checkpoint, and the suicide bomber jumped out and ran, after which police shot him, but in the meanwhile, he blew himself up. I mean, only two people injured, fortunately, rather than actually being killed. But in a country like Pakistan, it just seems that, you know, they have so many terror attacks of their own, a so-called Muslim country. Yeah, and it was in the town of Laki Marwat, apparently. This is basically the same sort of story. Now, there's also the problem, another story here from the Pakistan Daily Times, the English language version, saying about the problem of the Saudi kings, because what happens is 60 years in Saudi Arabia. Now, the country was founded in 1932 by Abdul Aziz ibn Saud. Now, he was quite a monster in many ways, and he was a monster who the British had helped to create because they had helped to fund him. And he destroyed pluralism and various other sects and forced his own very strict version of Wahhabist Islam on the country. But the thing is, for the last 60 years, every single ruler, every single king, now normally in Britain, for example, how kings get chosen, it's primogeniture. Primogeniture means that the firstborn son. So, you know, if there isn't a son, it's the daughter. But basically, traditionally, you would have a king would have, say, sons and daughters. But the firstborn son, if he died, his firstborn son would then take his place. And then the next in line would be the son of the son who was king. What has happened for the last 60 years in Saudi Arabia is that it has always been a question of everybody who has been a king for the last 60 years have been the sons of the very first king of Saudi Arabia. I mean, he called himself a king. He was just a descendant of a little ruler of a little tribal chief who had a date and olive grove in the Hejaz in Arabia. His ancestors were, anyway. But he became the first Saudi king from the House of Saud in 1932. And after that, every single king since then has been one of his sons for the last 60 years. And there has been no change. So what's going to happen is now the problem of who is going to... there have been five kings in all, you know, over the last 60 years. Some of them have been quite insane. And the current King Abdullah, the one who was in the plot by your American Muslim Brotherhood advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton, I mean, he would advise Hillary on how to run the iftar dinners. Oh, we have a caller, it seems. We have a caller in Skype. Oh, he's being vetted by Reese. Now, Abdurrahman al-Amudi had planned to kill Abdullah. He wasn't a king then. But now King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, he's 89. And so he's saying now that basically in the next 10 years, well, the editor-in-chief of a local English-language newspaper called the Saudi Gazette says that the younger generation will play a role. There's about 50 members of the royal family who basically make up the entire Saudi government, you know, all of the, you know, ministers, etc. So there is going to be a problem of who is going to take charge. Now we have somebody, all right, right, okay. Right. Well, you must tell me more later, Reese. Okay. Now, what else have we got in the news today? There's something in the Wall Street Journal, but I don't have the password for that. I'm not a full member anymore. 100 people have been injured today, as I began with the story of the clashes in Egypt. Let's see, anything... Right, now, if anybody wants to call in who's not a troll, please do so. Okay, now, George Galloway. Everybody loves a story about George Galloway. I mean, he's one of the most odious political figures in Britain. You know, he is somebody who has always been kissing the asses of dictators. I mean, he was kissing the ass of Saddam Hussein, calling him Your Excellency. And recently he's been kissing the ass of Bashar al-Assad. Can I say kissing the ass of? Yes, I can. Yes. Well, now he has actually, he was in the wilderness politically. He used to be the Member of Parliament for Bethnal Green, which is a region of East London, near where I used to live there. And now he's up in the north of Britain, in Bradford West. He is representing the Muslim community there. Even though the respectable elder Muslims said don't vote for him, a lot of the young, more fiery characters decided they wanted to support him. So now he's a member of Parliament again. Now, in March, he became the MP for Bradford West. And he's saying that he opposes the critics of the Syrian regime, which is led by his friend Bashar al-Assad. And he's saying that the critics of the regime, he opposed them because their enemies are worse than them. What he was saying was, as well, that he criticized the opposition to Syria because they won't lift a finger for jihad. it is absolutely bizarre. Now, he's saying that why was there no jihad in other Arab countries when those opposing Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, were ready to spend an ocean of blood? What, these are his words. He was speaking on a Lebanese TV station, and he was saying, what about their freedom in the other Arab countries? I'm not going to put on a dodgy Scots accent. He's saying, are they ready to fight there? No, they are collaborating with these other Arab countries. It is just strange to me that they are ready to kill thousands, maybe tens of thousands in Syria, but they will not lift a finger for jihad in other Arab countries, which are and have always been on the path of treason towards the Palestinian people. He's saying there are Arab countries where there is no freedom or liberty at all, which have one family rule, who even give the name of their family to their country. He's talking there about Saudi Arabia, but there is no jihad in such countries. But the jihad is in Syria, and it seems those who are fighting it are ready to spend an ocean of blood to get their freedom. This is... The guy is insane. It seems that, you know, when he's in Britain, he likes to criticize other people for being bigoted or against Muslims, and yet he's actively talking about jihad. He's given money to Hamas, a terrorist organization, his own money, and yet he sits in the Houses of Parliament in Britain. The guy is a total tosspot. That is a little pot that people masturbate into, if you want to know what it actually means. But still, I shouldn't mention that on air. Sorry, I'm going to have to probably change the rating of the show to, okay, so that's another strange story going on. Now, I'm really hoping that Morty's going to turn up, because if he doesn't, I might have to end the show a little bit earlier. Right. You're clever. Reese is very clever. You know, my co-host. She's there in the shadows. Without Reese, I would fall apart. But no, she's very, very clever in how she manipulates certain people who don't mean us too much good. But sometimes I think it's quite fun to play with trolls. I mean, I'd like to play with them live on air sometimes. Okay, so I've got various stories here, but I've just got links to the most basic things. Oh, was women imams in China. But, you know, what is going on in the Muslim world if the Muslim Brotherhood is having a bit of a leadership sort of schism? I think that could be a sign of good things to come. Now, somebody in an article somebody posted to me earlier on, which isn't from straight away, this is from a couple of days ago, a very interesting article from the International Herald Tribune, which is the global edition of the New York Times, saying that with David Petraeus being resigning from the CIA position because of the scandal about the woman he was having an affair with, which he admitted to, which is, you know, he said, "I've been having an affair, I resign." It's all a little bit bizarre, especially now that somebody else has been having an affair with the same woman. Now, this is an article by a man called Gregory D. Johnson, spelled J-O-H-N-S-E-N, who's saying... But with John Brennan, who is largely responsible for America's current flawed counter-terrorism strategy, Brennan is the possible candidate who is likely to get in. And he's saying he's the absolute worst person to put in power. Now, I have also maintained myself here, and I had big arguments with people in Britain on a blog that I frequently argue on, about the effectiveness of drone strikes. Drone strikes. Now, a drone attack, Richard C. Holbrooke set off the beginning of the use of drones during the Bosnian War, which took place between 1992 and 1996. Now, in that period, drones were very primitive. They had to be controlled from an airfield, and they had a big van or a truck, you know, full of data just to control one single drone. And it would only be capable of flying within, you know, a few tens of miles. Now you can control a drone from far, far away, from another continent, and with pinpoint accuracy, well, fairly pinpoint accuracy, you can then send hellfire missiles from an unmarked, unmanned flying airplane onto people or targets down below. But this has been going on so much. Now, it started during the in Pakistan and the tribal regions and in the regions, you know, where Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan, there are a lot of Pashtuns who live in Afghanistan and there are Pashtuns who live in Pakistan. They don't see the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan as really meaning anything. And when you were getting people fighting in Afghanistan, then crossing over the border into Pakistan and then saying, oh, we're in, you know, friendly territory, don't attack us. There, it was during the administration of George W. Bush that drone attacks started to take off. Now, they took off with a lot of success. They didn't do too many, but they hit some very important people, including the head of the poisons and explosives unit of Al-Qaeda. The third in command of Al-Qaeda was killed at the end of 2005. And the problem was that when Obama was asked in 2008, before the election, he was asked about how he would deal with terrorism. And he was saying then specifically in August 2008, candidate Senator Obama said that he would ensure that they would bomb Pakistan, the places in Pakistan where Al-Qaeda were hiding. So he already knew he had a strategy. Now, the Bush administration was carrying out drone strikes, and when the Obama administration came in, Obama brought in Richard C. Holbrook, who was the person who had been leading the drone attacks in Bosnia. What Holbrook had done was said to the three factions, the Croatians, the Serbs, and the Muslims, who were called Bosniaks, the three groups, he said to them, either you agree to the Dayton Peace Accords I have in front of me, or I'm going to bomb the crap out of all of you. So they all agreed. Now, Richard C. Holbrook, he died just over a year or so, 2 years ago. And unfortunately, the campaigns of drone attacks have carried on. And this person in the New York Times, this Johnson character, his full name is Gregory D. Johnson, is arguing quite cogently. They've been doing it in Yemen. They killed Anwar al-Awlaki with a successful drone strike. But he's arguing that you need to reduce the drone attacks, keep them to a bare minimum, just get to the people at the top. Because every time you have a drone strike hitting a house which is going to have collateral damage, neighbors, etc., get killed, you're going to create future terrorists. So you really need to keep the drone strikes targeted to the real big fish. And to do that, you need also to have good intelligence on the ground. And what this guy is saying is that John Brennan is just basically not somebody who really has much of an idea about anything and would find it easier to carry on with this dealing with counterterrorism as if it is a computer game, which it isn't. It really isn't. And you've got to accept that people on the ground, if you start bombing indiscriminately or thinking you've got information, that information must be right. I mean, it was very interesting to see the IDF footage of the Hamas man who had been responsible for the kidnapping of Gilad Shalit, and who also had been responsible for the outbreaks of Hamas rockets being fired for a week into... Saba's been banned for... No, she's not banned. No, she can come and talk here any time, Reese. Sorry. But this character, when he had his car was targeted, it hit him and didn't hit anybody else. I mean, the lights were still intact on the car. Precision attacks using good intelligence are necessary. Sadly, the Palestinians showed themselves to be Palestinian justice involved six Palestinians being accused of being spies for Israel. There were some very graphic photographs in the press this week of one person who was amongst these six people who were executed in front of a baying crowd. One of them was then tied to the back of a motorcycle, and a little convoy of other Hamas activists on motorbikes were then dragging this man's body through the streets of Gaza. This is the level of barbarism, basically, which is going on. Yeah, I mean, Reese, tell me more. I mean, you're telling the chat room. I'm seeing all these fascinating conversations going on in the chat room. Tell me more. She threatened Al and United West. Oh, what a bad girl. Now, this is somebody who had... Oh, come on, Reese, come and tell me, please. Tell me all about it, if you can. Ah, dear. Reese, are you there? Will you talk to me? Stop watching chat, she says. And then I'm being told, oh, gosh, you people are spoiled sports in the chat room. Okay, all right. But I'm just going to quote back from... Now, this guy, Gregory Johnson, he's just written a book about the last refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's war in Arabia. Now, it's a new perspective, because I'm so used to dealing with stories of drone attacks up in Pakistan, because of the way that, you know, Holbrook was brought in to specifically increase the amount of drone attacks, and they increased exponentially under Obama, which I think is a very bad thing, because they were hitting small targets, little groups of disaffected Muslim youths who traveled from Germany and other regions to then play at being jihadists. Whereas the real bigger fish weren't really on the radar. Now, there's another thing that's coming out in the media, which I'll just try and bring that up. Now, I'm not too sure of the source of this media because... Yes. Another story. I mentioned recently the story about the... there was a Shia Muslim school in Toronto. Now, this school had been, it was a Muslim Sunday school, and it had a rented space. Now, apparently, I'm having horrible things said about it. I'm not going to look at the chat room, I'm just going to hide it, because I've got an insurrection going on, you naughty girls, you know, sorry. But Anne and Kel and Reese, you need your bottom smacked very hard. Now, a Muslim Sunday school, a Shia Muslim Sunday school, was having all sorts of anti-Semitic statements in its books, which were being used for education. Now, there is a textbook has been found in a Jewish school in Thornhill. One of its textbooks apparently contains anti-Muslim language. Now, the Canadian CARE, instead of actually trying to deal with this one, so this is like a retaliation, because there were several I read out on the show a couple of weeks back. I read out about six different instances of anti-Semitism and hatred for Jews, which was in the books used by that Shia school. And nobody was charged with it. What happened is they just lost the space they were using. They weren't allowed to, you know, have their rented space. Now, instead of dealing with this, CARE publicised on Tuesday an open letter sent to several Jewish organisations and to the Ontario Minister of Education, and it's called for the textbook 2,000 Years of Jewish History from the Destruction of the Second Bais HaMikdash until the 20th Century, saying it's got to be removed from the curriculum. Now, this is a Sephardic school. It's the Jodwek or Haemet. Now, this textbook calls Muslims... Oh, dear. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. It calls Muslims rabid fanatics with savage beginnings. Okay, that's not very nice. And it characterizes the Prophet Muhammad as a rabid Jew hater. Yes, he was, and a child molester, and a genocidal man who actually slaughtered 700 Jewish males of the Banu Qurayza tribe, people who he had an apparent alliance with. He got paranoid, as mad dictators always do at the ends of their lives, and he had assumed they were plotting against him, so he took all of the women and children, sold them into slavery, took all of the males, had ditches dug in a town square, and then the people were made to sit on the edges of these trenches, and then their heads were sliced off, the heads would fall into the pit, and the bodies would follow after that. Muhammad killed about 700 Jewish males and actually sat and watched for a while until he got bored. This is not a good person. I would never invite Muhammad the Prophet round for tea. If I had any young female relatives in the house, I would have to lock them up for their own safety. Muhammad was a bastard. Sorry, he was. I don't care. Kill me. I've already had death threats. I don't give a shit anymore. And I'm dying of a lung condition slowly anyway, so that'll get me first. So, really, calling Muslims rabid fanatics with savage beginnings, I want to see the context. Unfortunately, CARE isn't going to give you the context. So, the story which they've then given to they've given to the Toronto Star to publish. Now, this is from Feldheim Publishers. It's the textbook's published in New York. And it teaches the school, the Orthodox Jewish Sephardic School, teaches grade 1 to 8 students. Said it was investigating the matter. So this is like tit for tat. This is like one school quoting from the Quran and in its textbook rabid anti-Semitism and hatred and saying Jews are schemers and things like that and liars and deceivers. And so they have then found one little passage in a book. Now, okay, if it calls Muhammad the Prophet a rabid Jew hater, well, that's true. Whether Muslims are rabid fanatics with savage beginnings is something I don't like to say, because most Muslims are not. But some definitely are. And I would say Salafists and Islamists are rabid fanatics. So, it just seems the media nowadays, I'm finding I'm reading press stories and I'm just seeing there are so many narratives. It is very interesting with the election which has happened recently in America. It's the same sort of thing of you've got one narrative sees the world one way, another narrative sees the other, but only one viewpoint, the liberal, leftist, anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic views seem to be the ones which are people are allowed to have those viewpoints. They can, but if you say anything bad about Islam or anything bad against the actions of certain Muslims, and specifically if you say anything bad against this so-called Prophet of Allah, I mean, another thing about Muhammad, if you believe the hadiths, Aisha, his child bride, whom he consummated the marriage with when she was 9 years old, now that would put him onto a, certainly he would be on Meghan's list if he was alive today. But she wrote in later life, or she told in the chains of transmission that led to the writing of the hadiths, she said that she, every morning, that when Muhammad went to go to the mosque, he would sleep in his clothes, but she had to wipe and scrape off with her fingernails. Now, this is getting to be, please forgive me for being a bit graphic now. She had to scratch with her fingernails from his clothing. He was prepared to just go out to the mosque with Bill Clinton-style white stains all over the front of his clothing. She used the word janaba. J Janaba means the impurities, the things that come out after sex, i.e. dried sperm was all over the front of his clothing. And he was quite happy to go out, you know, this 50, man in his late 50s, to go out to the mosque. As a child bride, she had to scrape off with her fingernails these white incrustations on his clothing. And this is the man of God that you can't say anything bad about. And yet it's in the bloody hadiths. I mean, oh, sorry. I'm going to play some music. Let's play some nice music. Yeah, because I don't want to start talking about nasty things. Because this is a nice show run by nice people who don't use bad language and they don't have sex with children or slaughter Jews, I hope. Okay, so let's go to a little bit of reggae. This is a new one. This is for Kel.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
Comment in the chat room. Okay, a little bit more information on this Muslim organization. Now, Kel's saying that, you know, it is just revenge. I just think that this whole thing, let's just go in the letter that Kerr sent. The entire chapter devoted to Islam presents a pernicious and extreme portrayal of Muslims and the Islamic faith. The material further denigrates the Prophet Muhammad as a rabid Jew hater and falsely portrays Islam as inherently anti-Semitic and devoted to hating Jews. It's in the Quran. Do not take a Jew or a Christian as a friend. These are lying bastards in the Canadian Care. They really, really are. You know, if it says, do not take the Jews or the Christians as your friends, if it says Jews are descendants of apes and pigs in the Quran, which it does, if it says that you must tax Jews and Christians as second-class citizens, then it is anti-Semitic. No two ways about it. And this is the problem. Most decent people who, most Muslims are decent people who don't take all of that crap in the Quran seriously. They just think, well, God is God, and they ignore all the nasty things. We are like the people in The Sixth Sense, you know, the dead people. We see what we want to see. You know, there are things in the Bible, in the Old Testament, or the Tanakh, you know, which are pretty horrible. But the Talmud came along and, you know, things were improved upon. So people don't dwell on those. They take them, a lot of the things, as being allegorical. The Quran has so many people who follow it, who don't even read it. In Turkey, there used to be a case where 65% of people didn't even, this is back in 2005, in one survey, said that they didn't have a Quran in the house. Now it's changed because, you know, Turkey's run by an Islamist, you know, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is trying to enforce Islamist principles upon the whole country again. But, you know, there was a long period of secularism in Turkey. But the thing is, most Muslims don't take the nasty things in Islam and in the Quran too seriously. But groups like CARE are all about disinformation. One of the most disgusting things that they did was taking Rosa Parks' legacy. When Rosa Parks died in 2006, now, she'd been a Christian. She had been the lady who, on the bus in Alabama, she was sewing on a seat at the front of the bus. She was told she must get up and sit at the back, and she refused, and she was jailed. She helped to set off the civil rights movement. Now, Rosa Parks, from what she did in Birmingham, Alabama, became a national icon. And at the end of her life, poor lady was suffering from Alzheimer's. She wasn't able to make any decisions about anything. And when she died, she had always been a Christian. When she died, the head of CARE in America announced at an iftar dinner with George W. Bush that CARE would be setting up a bursary for the Rosa Parks Award for people who had done services to the spreading of Islam. This is an insult to this woman's memory, and it also, it's exploiting her name, and it doesn't even give any money. It's only like $1,000, which isn't really very much for, you know, a national award. For anybody who can prove that they've been trying to resist Islamophobia. I mean, Islamophobia is a word which has become totally meaningless. And I think in countries like Britain, I don't know, maybe I'm just myself, or maybe I've just decided I'm no longer going to pretend anymore. But I think people are being a lot more open now about how, why the hell must we always be bullied by Islamists? And the people in CARE are Islamists. They have had terrorists amongst their number. These are people who lie and deceive and swindle, and who then have their leading figures go out to Iran, a regime which is hell-bent on destroying Israel, and then hypocritically, the Canadian branch of CARE is now complaining about how it falsely portrays Islam as inherently anti-Semitic, whereas they're quite happy to go with an anti-Semitic regime and to appear on press TV and be paid by press TV to appear. I tell you, I appeared on press TV once and I refused to take a fee. I did take a fee for my transport from out in the wild wilderness where I live to go back to London to appear in their little studio in Hanger Lane. I briefly appeared and I got one supporter of Hamas very upset with me and he lost his temper, but I refused to take any money because this was in a regime which was killing its own civilians. A regime which has had a leader, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who since 2005, on more than four occasions, has called for the wiping of Israel off the map. Of course I'm not going to take money from a regime like that. But CARE doesn't mind. CARE will get into bed with anybody. I mean, they're the cheapest hookers in the block. Sorry. They have no discrimination. But they like to twist and to provoke and claim to be a Muslim advocacy group, whereas they're an Islamist advocacy group, which has founded with Saudi money. Again, we don't know why and how this Saudi money is floating about and what it's used for. This is something which really Sharia financing must be, you know, looked at. But anyway, that's just one thing there. I think that this is this story from Toronto, it really is quite annoying. It is one textbook. This isn't the numerous textbooks, which is what was basically at the Shia one that was up earlier. Anyway, let's see any more interesting stories. In Bosnia, Bosnian Muslims are protesting against Israel. Oh, what a surprise. I mean, you know, Israel is such a... I think it frustrates the Muslim world because it's so successful. You know, it has a tolerant liberal democracy. It has 20% of its population are Muslims. And yet Mohammed Abbas, in November 2010, publicly said that when there is a Palestinian state, that there will be no Israelis allowed to live there. And yet Israel has 20% of its population is Arab. So, I don't know. We have a very, very strange situation. 2,000 Muslims staged a protest march today to condemn the aggression against the Palestinians. This is what has got me so angry over the last week. I mean, I was angry last week, you know, because I could see it was all going that way. I mean, that the media, you know, you have Gaza, Hamas sends missile after missile after missile into Jewish communities, so Muslim Jewish women have to protect their children. They have to have their kids scared by sirens, worried that they're going to be blown to bits. And after days and days of non-stop rocket attacks, finally Israel retaliates, and all of a sudden the world's media then takes an interest. And, oh look, big Israel and little Palestinian girls and people all suffering and suffering. Isn't it terrible? I'm bloody pissed off with all of this whinging and whining. This is what they did in 2006. This is what they did in 2000 when they had the Operation Cast Lead thing in 2008. It is just deliberate provocation to then say, oh look, you know, we're the victims. I mean, I am fed up with it. And the way that the British media, the American media, people are just taking this idea of Israel as this big evil aggressor. If you were being bombed every day, the fact that you haven't got so many people killed by those bombs does not mean to say that these bombs are not dangerous. They may be homemade, but they are still dangerous. And this really does annoy me, that the media likes to mythologize. Everything has to be like a Hollywood movie. You have to have goodies and baddies. And unfortunately, there's another aspect of Gaza which people don't seem to actually realize, that, you know, one thing about Gaza is that babies being born with rickets are on the increase at the moment. The reason for this is rickets, it's a vitamin D deficiency, and people are not getting enough sunlight. The women in Gaza, they may look well fed because a lot of them are fat, but that's because they don't go out very much. They stay indoors and just have babies. But there has been a massive increase in the amount of babies being born with rickets because the mothers have not had enough vitamin D from sunlight on their skins, and then the babies growing in their wombs are being malnourished and are suffering as a result. And when a baby has rickets, eventually it gets a thing called osteomalacia. Now, osteomalacia is where you get softening of the bone. Traditionally, in the old days, rickets would be characterized by people with bent femurs. You know, the thigh bone would be bent into sort of, you know, an arched shape. Now, what is happening with the increase of babies being born with rickets is that when these babies reach about 12 months, they have violent, extremely painful convulsions. They have fits, and then they're sort of, their bodies are having tremors. They're in extreme pain. Now, I'm sorry, if you are a mother and you're giving birth to a child who has become starved of vitamin D. Now, if you want to starve yourself of vitamin D, that's your choice. If you're giving birth to a baby who is going to have pain, all because you were so selfish that you followed your religious dogma to the degree where you deprived yourself of sunlight and allowed your child to suffer, I'm sorry, there is nothing godly in that. It is political. It just makes a statement. All these Muslim women wearing the garb, you know, to show, for the Muslim men to show, look, we have a presence. They pretend to be dressed like other people, but their women have to dress up as tents to then show Islam is here. There is something very sick going on in the world at the moment. And okay, I may sound like a bigot. I don't intend to be. I'm very anti-racism, but I just am sick to the back teeth of seeing our societies being lied to by having Muslim so-called representatives giving this fake taqiyya version. Now, I'm sorry, I used to be a Buddhist. And even in Buddhist, one in the Buddhist sect that I belong to, there was taqiyya even there, where we were made to, well, not forced, you know, but one of the rituals that one did was chanting in a bowdlerized version of ancient Chinese, as Japanese people thought it was meant to sound. And we would chant this part of a sutra, which was a story about how a father lies to his children to make them take medicine which they need. And it's virtually saying that, you know, the story there is saying that it's legitimate to lie. And I found that was very, very problematic. But taqiyya, this lying in Islam, it is something that has gone on. It goes on in other religions, but we are having so many people who are pretending that there is a good Islam, which they've never really encountered, and claiming that it's been corrupted by people like Al-Qaeda, etc. And it just seems the only thing that seems to get Muslims together from different groups and stopping them from killing and attacking each other is to bring up the word Israel, and all of a sudden they are united. Anyway, I'm going to close off now on a piece of music, which is going to be the final part of the show. And we'll just have enough time to take us through to the end. Thank you very much to Reese Cup. Thank you to people in the chat room. And this is going to be the last part of the show. I'm not going to come back after this because I need to go off and do things. Please listen to the Red Fox radio show if you can. If you can also listen, I'm going to go and do this now as well in a minute. I'm going to go to listen on Live League to Rabbi Ariel Nachman Ben Chaim and the House of Seven Beggars Synagogue. But I'm going to play some tea music now. Thank you very much. Okay, well, we're about to be cut off now, but thank you very much for listening, and please listen again next week. Thank you, Risika. Thank you, the chat room people. I've been Adrian Morgan on Vocal Security Matters. Listen again next Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you very much, and good night.